Welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I'm your host, Divyani Garg from Delhi, India. Pregnancy in Parkinson's disease presents unique challenges, yet clear guidance has long been limited. Today, I'm joined by Professor Alexander Lin, a movement disorder specialist from Princess Alexandra Hospital, Brisbane, Australia, who is the lead author of a recent MDS Scientific Issues Committee review, which discusses practical approaches to the management of pregnancy in Parkinson's disease, particularly pertaining to before, during, and after the pregnancy. Dr. Lin, thank you very much for joining me for today's episode.
Thank you for having me.
Let me begin by asking you, then I also noted in this review that it is actually an amalgamation of the efforts of the MDS Scientific Issues Committee, but along with that, the subgroup of the Early Onset Parkinson's Disease Study Group of MDS Women and Movement Disorders Special Interest Group. And the authors spanned a large number of specialties, including persons with lived experience of pregnancy and Parkinson's disease. So what prompted the MDS Scientific Issues Committee to develop this review, and why was this amalgamation of experts important?
Yeah, well, thanks very much to get this whole group together for a good reason. And I'm part of the MDS Scientific Issues Committee, but this is very much not just a Scientific Issues Committee paper, and the other group members that have participated from the groups that you mentioned were absolutely integral in the development of this. For us, it was important that we have something clinically relevant in this issue of managing pregnancy and pregnancy-related problems in women with Parkinson's disease, because this is one of those issues where there's very little data available at the moment, but those issues occur frequently enough that people amongst us who see patients many times with movement disorders certainly will experience issues and come across those patients many times. So what we wanted to get together is a group of professionals who have some expertise in those various areas. So many of us are neurologists, but we have obstetric medicine specialists, some psychiatrists were involved as well. And as you mentioned, two of the authors are both doctors, but both women with lived experience with Parkinson's disease. And for us, that was really important that we have them involved as well to include really meaningful data and guidance for health professionals, but patients as well, to have a pragmatic guideline that people hopefully will find helpful in clinical practice.
Yeah, that's really fantastic. And something that I really liked when I was going through the review was that you emphasize that every visit with a woman of reproductive age group who has Parkinson's disease is in fact an opportunity for preconception counseling. So what would be neurologists or other clinicians or people who are managing these persons be routinely discussing with them, even if the woman is not immediately contemplating pregnancy? What would be the routine guidance?
Yeah, I think that's something important for all of us to learn. And I'm not asking neurologists to be pregnancy specialists or obstetric specialists by all means. But as you made that point, that is something that we really wanted to get across, that every consultation you have with a woman of reproductive age, in our case, with Parkinson's disease, is an opportunity just to have some discussions, even if a pregnancy, for example, is not currently planned or not at all planned. And that does not necessarily mean detailed family planning for those patients, but just have discussions around the topic to normalize those conversations early as well. And there's some key points I think that are important. One, for example, to reassure patients who think about starting families, having babies in the future, that Parkinson's disease itself does not appear to reduce fertility, and pregnancy outcomes don't seem to be adversely affected either in women with Parkinson's disease. And the data is pretty clear, and I think that is something important to get across to patients. Then it's also important to discuss medication choices, and for patients and treating doctors to understand that the choices of medications might have implications later, and we'll probably discuss some of the difficult discussions around it afterwards. For example, amantadine is a drug that we know is harmful for the unborn babies, to plan ahead for that early, but also, for example, to discuss trajectories of symptoms. How might your symptoms develop during pregnancy, or let's say as you try to become pregnant, or let's even say if you might undergo IVF treatment trying to be pregnant, what might this mean for your symptoms during that period? Then, for example, have discussions around genetic considerations? Would genetic testing be something you want to consider beforehand? So patients, when it really comes to it, don't feel rushed into those discussions and decisions, but have some time to reflect on these issues. And I think even just brief conversations around it can prevent a lot of angst and panic-driven decisions then later in the process.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful. To consider just having a conversation around the topic itself might be some barrier that we can try to overcome. Another very important, and perhaps it's not that common a scenario, but what if a patient who has genetic Parkinson's disease, and this lady contemplates pregnancy and comes to you as a clinician, what is something that we can do in terms of approaching the conversations around genetic counseling and genetic testing in such scenarios?
Yeah, certainly in this age group of patients, a very important topic, and particularly in women with Parkinson's disease who might consider starting families or having families. Again, just as much as I'm not asking neurologists to become obstetricians, neurologists do not have to be geneticists, but in the area we work in, some understanding around it is important and have some grasp of how to manage these issues I do think is important as well. I think it's first of all important for us to understand that genetic counseling should be offered. This is not imposed. So people don't have to have genetic counseling. Many women with early onset Parkinson's disease are super keen to have a lot of information, as much information as possible at hand, so they can make decisions in an informed way. But some women or some families might not want to. And of course, it's absolutely valid as well. And just having those discussions to understand their wishes, I think, is really important. For me personally, and I'm not asking other people to do exactly what I do, if I, for example, as you say, have a patient with a confirmed genetic condition, having some understanding and being able to explain patients basic inheritance patterns, things like penetrance and uncertainties around that, I think that's something even as non-geneticists, we probably should be able to do in a reasonable way with families. Then also, for example, to explain to patients and their families or separate the difference between things like genetic risk and disease severity, because these are often conflated, to be able to explain those things. But then also, absolutely, particularly in this group, to really involve a trained geneticist early so they can have more in-depth discussions around that. So lay the groundwork, but I would, for really all cases, suggest to offer involvement by a geneticist early. And then, I'm not asking for people to know all the details around that, but for women who might wish to explore options further, to at least be able to have some basic discussions about pre-implantation genetic testing, prenatal testing, and of course explain to patients that is absolutely based on their autonomy and informed choice. But I think families being aware that these options in many countries are available nowadays, I do think is important.
Yeah, that's a really important thing that you said, to definitely lay the groundwork, but also get involvement of the clinical geneticists, maybe for detailed discussions. So let us go to something that you alluded to earlier. And what are some of the most common, let us say, medication-related pitfalls that clinicians should avoid while managing pregnant women with Parkinson's disease? For example, like you had mentioned regarding amantadine, which is contraindicated. So adjustment may suggest a risk of motor worsening in these scenarios. So how should one go about balancing that?
Yeah, so I think if you can get the pre-planning right, a lot of those acute issues can be avoided very early. So discussions early, ideally plan for pregnancies early. Having said that, of course, life happens and sometimes pregnancies might happen without planning ahead. So we need to be able to act on acute situations as well. I think generally a common pitfall is that people overreact and make dramatic changes too quickly, although they might not be necessary, particularly with often limited information that is available. I guess a few pointers that we need to know, overall little data, but there's reasonable data that levodopa, so either in the form of levodopa carbidopa or levodopa benzerazide, is reasonably well studied, appears to be very safe, and that as a monotherapy is a very safe option. Really, from then onwards, all other agents we use, the available evidence gets very thin, and for many of the other agents, we have limited data. Dopamine agonists appear to be pretty safe as well, but we have limited data for most of the other agents. What we do know is amantadine is clearly unsafe, clearly harmful for the unborn baby. So that is something I would strongly suggest. If there's any thoughts, ideas about becoming pregnant, really get it out early. And of course, if you have a patient who has fallen pregnant, really stop amantadine as soon as you can. And I think you touched on that already as well. It is important to know as well, many of us, I think, are overcautious then and try to be super, super safe. And yes, absolutely, only levodopa. But for many patients with young onset Parkinson's disease, with often then significant motor fluctuations, it's really difficult to just maintain them purely on levodopa. So in discussion with patients and their families, of course, need to really weigh up risk and potential benefits for patients. And don't forget, there is also a risk of being undertreated, obviously for the patient, but also for the unborn baby. There might be aspiration risk for the patient herself. There might be the reduced ability to actually give birth for a person who's undertreated, or reduced ability to look after the newborn baby afterwards. So these are not just theoretical risks that need to be taken into consideration as well.
Yeah, I think from what I understand, you're saying that given the evidence, imantadine is definitely to be taken off or not advisable. Levodopa is safe in whichever combination, carbidopa or benzericide. But for the others, we probably need to deal with it on an individual case-to-case basis in discussion with the patient.
Absolutely. So I can give you one example. One of my patients just has given birth a few months ago, and we actually, in discussion, then remained her on levodopa, carbidopa, and entacapone, because purely basic levodopa monotherapy was clearly not managing her motor symptoms adequately. And she had a wonderful, healthy baby, so it all went well. But I appreciate this is a certain calculated risk to take, but I think we need to be pragmatic in those situations as well.
Yeah, that's really helpful, actually. So let me just shift gears a little bit towards the non-motor aspects, because pregnancy is a condition where we do encounter women with a lot of non-motor challenges. What are some of the practical screening strategies that you would recommend?
Yeah, look, I would suggest be proactive. Like in most other areas, knowing what you're dealing with helps a lot rather than be caught off guard when things are really severe. There are obviously certain non-motor issues that are particularly an issue in pregnant women who have Parkinson's disease. So nausea, of course, is an issue. Nausea and vomiting, major issue. So you think not being able to keep medication down or absorb medication, of course, is a major issue. As you can imagine, orthostatic hypotension is a big issue in pregnant women generally, but even more so in pregnant women with Parkinson's disease. You can imagine sleep disturbance, a common problem in patients with Parkinson's anyway, but even more during pregnancy. Constipation, of course, a major issue in patients with Parkinson's, even more so during pregnancy. So there are several of these non-motor issues that are particularly important to address in it. So I don't think there are any surprises. So what I would suggest for us health professionals to be structured to routinely screen, particularly for these more common non-motor issues, rather than wait for patients to volunteer these symptoms. And I think that'd be perfectly fine with just a tick and flick, okay? Just go through the more common non-motor issues every time you see a patient. And then I would suggest, because these can be very complicated to manage then, really get in touch with your obstetric medicine team or obstetricians, or depending on the other issues, psychiatry team or physiotherapy team early, and manage those in a multidisciplinary fashion.
Yeah, so it would be useful to just go through that non-motor symptoms checklist, like you suggest, particularly in these patients. Yeah. Deep brain stimulation, or DBS, is being increasingly offered to patients with Parkinson's disease. How should pregnancy planning influence the timing of DBS, if at all, and what should neurologists remember about DBS in pregnancy?
So I do think this is something we will all encounter more frequently going forward, that we have young women with Parkinson's who had DBS surgery and then think about getting pregnant. So actually, my patient has just given birth. We actually did DBS surgery on her in preparation for pregnancy, and she had a healthy baby with DBS in situ. So it can be done. And another thing to consider in terms of medication, potential medication risks we discussed beforehand, having DBS done might actually, of course, reduce fetal exposure to certain medications, which is important as well. Clearly, timing matters in that regard. So this is something that needs to be pre-planned. You don't want to do DBS surgery in a pregnant patient then. And there are other aspects of that should be thought of beforehand as well. So generally, for this patient cohort in particular, we would suggest rechargeable batteries rather than non-rechargeable batteries. If you do have a patient with a non-rechargeable battery, we can often predict how long those batteries will last to make sure if the battery might need to be replaced during the pregnancy period. Replace the battery beforehand. Don't push your luck and wait until the battery runs out while the patient is pregnant and then all of a sudden you get into trouble. There are some important aspects for the labor period, peripartum period, that are important to know as well. So one is stimulation. DBS stimulation usually is switched off during delivery because the DBS stimulation interferes with fetal monitoring. So that's something for us neurologists to be aware of. Having said that, and that's something people should be able to discuss with their patients as well, DBS itself is not a contraindication for vaginal delivery or for breastfeeding, which we might come to later as well. So both of these are possible in patients who had DBS as well. Clearly, these are, again, patient groups you really want to link in very closely with your obstetric medicine team and your anesthetist to manage those patients appropriately.
Yeah, very important points, all of those. And on that topic, let us also talk about breastfeeding, because breastfeeding decisions can be quite complex. So how can we counsel patients about breastfeeding while they're on anti-Parkinsonian medications or any other caveats?
Yeah, shared decision-making is really important in this group. Of course, there's limited data available. We do know from what we do have available that levodopa is actually exposed in the breast milk, but the exposure rate is very small and it appears to be safe in infants as well. So that's good to know. As you might remember from your medical school times, dopamine drugs might reduce lactation. So there might be an issue as well. And I guess something to link in with the multidisciplinary team. If there are women who want to breastfeed, and if that's their choice, we should absolutely support that in any way we can, then levodopa monotherapy for those reasons is preferred, if at all possible. Dopamine agonists are possibly safe, but are more limited in data and might suppress lactation. And of course, then baby's health needs to be monitored closely in women who choose to breastfeed whilst being on medication.
Okay, that's super helpful. And I also wanted to ask you about PregSpark. So how do registries like PregSpark help move this field forward towards evidence-based guidelines, and how can clinicians support this effort?
Yeah, no, I think it's an absolutely fantastic job the team around PregSpark has done with it, because they address the very central problem that we discussed and the reason why we're both here today, which is the lack of systematic data in this group. We will realistically never have randomized controlled trials for these issues, so that's really not feasible. So having well-designed registries like PregSpark really is the best path forward for us. And what PregSpark and similar kind of registries allow for is global data that's patient-reported, longitudinal follow-up for health of both mothers as well as the children, and really have real-world insight into many of those issues that we struggle with. And we have limited data so far, so medication safety, delivery outcomes in those patient groups, disease trajectories during pregnancy. So I strongly urge all of you out there, be aware of it, flag it up for your patients and around discussions. So hopefully I don't butcher it now, but the website is www.pregspark, so PregSpark.com. So make sure you tell your patients about that. Really simple to sign up, really important to sign up for all your patients.
Thank you, Dr. Len. It has been absolutely wonderful to converse with you. Thank you so much for joining me for this podcast today.
Thank you very much for having me.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.